My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is April 7th, 2004. Midtown is my home group, and I have a sponsor. And I'm very grateful to be asked to do anything with Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, thank you very much for asking me to come out. And especially, you know, being asked to do something for a group that I know loves and respects Alcoholics Anonymous the way I was taught, you know. And I've come down here before and had a great time and always been welcome. So thank you for having us. And yeah, so I have, 55 minutes. The good news is that it's very easy for me to talk a lot about myself, you know. The bad news is sometimes I forget how to stop. But so I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I didn't come from a broken home. I didn't come from any difficult circumstances. You know, my parents are still married today. They've been married 37 years, or 38 years this June, you know. I have two younger brothers. We grew up going to church every Sunday. I went to Bible school, you know, and when I was a kid, the books we used to read were like the Bible story, like illustrated Bible stories, you know. And my parents tried as best they could to raise us with their convictions, their morals, you know, a sense of right from wrong, you know. And and I was given everything I ever needed. You know, I didn't always have everything I wanted, but most people don't, you know. And I had a great life. I had a great childhood, you know. And there's no logical reason why I should be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, of course, I mean, if you ask a lot of people in society, you know, I have nothing to blame it on. You know, it just is. And I can tell you that from as early as I can remember, I had an extreme sense of self-centeredness and selfishness. You know, from as early as I can remember, if I wanted something, I just took it. If I could lie to you to get it, I'd do that and not really even think about it. I mean, I was taught that lying was wrong, right? I was taught that stealing was wrong. I was taught that all these things were wrong. But when push came to shove, when it came in between what I wanted, I just did what I wanted. You know, and I can remember getting into a lot of trouble as a kid long before I took a drink. I mean, I was just talking in a meeting the other day about I was in a Walgreens with my mom, and she was getting something from the pharmacy. And I'm probably like 5 or 6 years old, and I'm standing in the little toy aisle. You know, I saw little Hot Wheels that I wanted. And I just took it out of the pack and stuck it in my pocket. And some guy saw me doing it. I didn't even try to hide it. You know, I just stuck it in my pocket. And then some guy had to tell my mom that I stole it. She made me go to the manager and apologize, you know. And that's just kind of how I was, you know, just selfish and self-centered in the extreme. And I hear a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about a great sense of discomfort, right, feeling apart from the world around me, you know. And that was definitely true for me, probably not until I got a little bit closer to adolescence. But, you know, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. There's a lot of people in this world who feel uncomfortable, who aren't going to drink and die like I am, you know. And But it led me to do just crazy, tragic things, you know, to try, because I couldn't figure out, like, what the problem was, right? This unnamed anxiety. You know, I sat in front of countless therapists and psychiatrists and psychologists, you know, and when I get in trouble, teachers, parents, friends' parents, the principal's office, police officers, coaches, all of them asking me the same three questions, really. Why did you do that? What's wrong with you? And what were you thinking? You know, and every single time I got asked that question, I said, I don't know. And I was being absolutely honest. I remember it frustrated the hell out of my father, because he was like, you know, I was thinking, I really don't. I really don't know why I did that. And but, you know, because I felt uncomfortable. I thought maybe it's because I didn't fit into life the way these other people did. So I would do things to try and get their approval, to get their attention, you know, whether it's like being the class clown or just doing destructive things to try and get people to like me, you know, because you know how boys are, you know. And I remember I went to middle school, and I was living, you know, I was born in Omaha, Nebraska, you know, and we moved down to Texas, and I was living in Houston. And when I went to middle school, I went to this pretty rough middle school. You know, I mean, we lived in a nice middle-class neighborhood surrounded by bad neighborhoods. And the middle school I went to, you were either getting beat up by people in gangs or you were in the gangs. And it didn't take me a whole lot of time to figure out which side of that bargain I wanted to be on, you know. And so I started running around these gangs and, you know, doing things and getting in trouble and just acting in a way that I wasn't raised to. I mean, I was 13 years old running around this Mexican gang with a gun tucked in my pants, you know, that I bought for $20 and a Snoop Dogg CD, I think, you know. And I didn't know anything about being tough, I'm from Omaha. You know what I mean? There's good people out there. There's not a lot of tough guys out in Omaha. But so I didn't know anything about it. You know, and in order to fit the image, right, to fit into the crowds that I wanted to, I needed to, like, study these things. Like I said, it's like the early 90s, you know, so I went out and I got a Snoop Dogg CD, the Dr. Dre CD. I, like, listened to them and studied them to figure out, like, what I needed to do to, like, fit this image of a gangster, you know, and made sure I got the right clothes and listened to the right music, you know, and hung out with the right people. And all because I just had this great sense of discomfort, you know, and I had no idea why. And if you act like that, and you sit in front of, like, psychologists and psychiatrists, they give you a lot of fancy diagnoses, right? Because, I mean, if you're not drinking, it can't be alcoholism, right? You have to drink to be an alcoholic. And so I got, you know, anxiety disorders, attention deficit disorder, depression, you know, manic depression, all this stuff. Just because these doctors are trying to figure, oh, I got psychopath too. That was a good one. But yeah, my mom couldn't take me to a new doctor, you know, and I went in for 1 hour, and when I came out, the doctor pulled my mom aside, and he said, your son's a psychopath. And she said, we are never going back there again, you know. which, I mean, in retrospect, it might have been true. I don't know. You know, I mean, the big book says that there's some of us that are psychopaths, you know, and but that was years, and I got kicked out of school. Like, they found me with a gun, and they don't like that. I mean, this is before the age of, like, school shootings and stuff, so there wasn't, like, that whole stigma. But, like, they don't like you bringing firearms to school. And so they kicked me out, you know, and I got put in this adolescent psych ward, you know, lockdown facility. And I mean, even in there, like, my alcoholic thought process goes through. You know, I remember walking in, and there's this guy in the padded room with the bubble window on the door, right, just going berserk. And when he came out, it seemed like he was the man on the ward. You know, nobody messed with this guy. You know, people seemed like the crazy people seemed to respect him. So my thought process was, I need to get into that room. What do I need to do to get in that room? You know, and I'm sick. I'm real sick. But I got out of there, you know, and this is years before I took a drink. You know, my dad had a job which allowed us to move around frequently after that. You know, we lived in Texas for like 9 years. And we started moving around every year or two because he would get transferred with his job. And everywhere we went, I would reinvent myself, right? I would reinvent the image that I wanted to present to you. You know, when I was in Houston, it was like the gangster image. You know, when I moved to the Netherlands, it was kind of the same. They went to this international school, and I was like trying to present this image of like this tough American gangster kid. And, you know, I mean, some people fell for it, some people didn't, you know. But everywhere I went, you know, I would just try and, like, make you believe what I wanted you to think about me, which was really what I wanted to believe that I was, you know, because I was so terrified of letting anyone actually know who I mean, I didn't know who I was, but the idea that you might know that I'm not what I'm telling you was terrifying to me. And, you know, then we moved to London, and oddly enough, I did not start drinking when I was living in Amsterdam. I don't know why. It seemed like years later, I would regret that entirely. But you know, we moved to London, and I didn't know anyone. You know, and I was at this point, my image was skater, right? And I had the whole facade. You know, I had the skateboard, the pants. I mean, I looked the part. You know, but I couldn't skate. And but I tried, kind of. But really, it's more important to look the part than actually be the part. You know. And I started hanging around with these British skater kids, you know, and they went into the liquor store over there, and I went with them. And I had taken sips off my dad's beer and drank some of his Johnny Walker, you know, stuff like that. But my parents, they don't really drink. I'll get to their liquor cabinet later. But they just don't drink like I do. So I went in with these British kids, and they're like, what you want? Right? And I was like, I don't know, whatever you're getting. And they had this stuff. They don't sell it here. This stuff is delicious. It's old English cider, right? It just comes in like a wine bottle looking thing. It's like 20% alcohol, and it's just delicious, you know. And they got out. They just chugged it. So I did what they did. I chugged it, you know. And I'm hanging out with these guys that I'm normally intimidated by, normally just totally uncomfortable around, and all of a sudden I wasn't worried about what they thought about me anymore, right? Like I wasn't worried about whether I was like saying the right things or doing the right things. I wasn't worried about how terrible of a skater I was, you know. And I started a fight, you know. I urinated in a car of the subway, you know. And I had a great time, you know. It was great. And looking back on it now, and from other people's experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could tell that really what it was it was the first time in my life I was absolutely carefree. It was the first time in my life that I had no worries about the entire about what, you know, was going on in the world and how it affected me, you know. And now the next day I didn't think that. The next day I thought last night was awesome and I can't wait to do it again. You know, I didn't ease into it. I know some people talk about how they started drinking on the weekends, but I heard somebody in my home group describe it as walking across a frozen lake and falling through the ice, you know, and that was how my drinking was. Like, I hit it, and I just went straight for it, you know, and within a week, I was hanging out with the kind of people that I knew were living like that, you know, and I mean, you know how it is. We can walk into a room of total strangers and find our people like that, and I can do it today, and I mean, there wasn't really a terrible consequence. At this point, like, I would already steal from my parents to get what I wanted, so when I stole for liquor, it wasn't like I was, like, you know, going to some new realm, you know. I lied to them to do other things. Now I was just lying to them so I could drink the way I wanted to drink and go where I wanted to go. And I think that they started in my grades. I mean, I was always like a C and D student. You know, overachieving has never been one of my characteristics. You know, and so when I started drinking, it was just like a straight line, right? Like, he's just still doing not that great. And I think that was like my freshman year when I started drinking, freshman year of high school. By my sophomore year of high school, my parents started to realize that I was kind of burnt out all the time, and there was probably something wrong. Like, I was on drugs, you know. I think they thought I was drinking what I was, but at this point, when you're 16, I mean, even over there, it's just easier to get the other stuff, you know. And I didn't really fall in love with liquor until I moved back to the United States. And at this point, my parents sent me to a boarding school because they couldn't deal with me, you know. I went to this port, and we moved to the D.C. area for my dad's work, and I got sent up to Pennsylvania to go to a boarding school. And once again, I instantly found the people that drank the way I drank, you know. And I remember this one time. It was probably about a year after we moved back, and my substance use was pretty even this whole time, you know. But the end of my senior year, I vividly remember the first time that I had the real epiphany from alcohol. You know, I went to this restaurant with four girls that I would normally be terrified of, right? Like, the really hot, popular girls in my grade, and I drank about a quarter of a bottle of Jack Daniels before we went. And we went, and man, they were just loving hanging out with me. I was making them laugh. I was cracking such good, witty jokes, you know. And I thought, man, this is all I have to do. If I can just stay drunk every minute of the rest of my life, I won't have any problems, right? Like, I can just charm my way through life. And that was really what I thought, you know, and I didn't see anything wrong with that. You know, I'd watch movies like The Doors, and I'd see Jim Morrison. He was like my idol. Like, that man can drink whiskey. You know what I mean? I want to be able to drink whiskey like that. Yeah, the problem with that is I had no musical talent or fame, you know. But, you know, after high school, I graduated at the bottom of my class. Everybody I know went off to college, and I went to my parents' basement. You know, and my dad, he's a self-made man. You know, he's never given me anything for nothing. You know, it's something that was instilled for me from the beginning. And he told me if I moved back in the house after high school, I was paying rent. You know, and what he offered me was very reasonable, $300 room and board. You know, very reasonable. And I couldn't get it together. I got a job waiting tables, right? So every single day I would go into work, and every single night I would come out with just a stack of cash in my hand. And every single morning I'd wake up and it was all gone. You know, and I had every intention when I went into work that day of taking that money and putting it away so that I could pay my dad the rent, or I could, you know, pay my insurance bill, or whatever it was. You know, every intention, but I could never do it. Because when it came down to drinking, it took precedent over everything. You know, and the problems started to pile up, right? The big book says that our problems pile up and become astonishingly difficult to solve, you know. And one night, this is the simplest example of my obsession for alcohol, right? Because I have the phenomenon of craving, the obsession of the mind, you know. And when I start taking a drink, when I start drinking, most likely I'm just going to get blind drunk. Unless there's something that's going to stop me, I'm not going to stop until I'm just out of it, puking or passing out. And if I'm not drinking, all I can think about is drinking. Every minute of the day is, how am I going to get a drink? When am I going to get drunk? You know, and then once I actually have the liquor in my possession, I start to calm down because I know it's coming, you know. But I was at my dad's house, and I was out of booze. I was out of money. And like I said, they had this liquor cabinet, you know, and they have one of those liquor had one of those liquor collections that I still admire today. You know, I did contracting for a few years. I had a little business, you know, after I got sober. I'd be in and out of people's houses doing work, and every once in a while I'd go into someone's house, and they wouldn't have the Armoire style liquor cabinet, right? All the bottles would be stacked up on top, and I would just look at it, man, that is awesome. Look at that. That is just an admirable collection of liquor. You know, you can almost imagine like the brown glow coming off the bottles and the angels singing in the background. And I would have these aspirations of creating my own liquor collection. Like, I really just want to have a table like this just stacked full of bottles. You know, so I'd go to the store and I'd get a couple bottles. And the next day they'd both be gone. You know, and I was like, damn, I got to start again. And it just never happened. But my parents have one of those collections because they do things like, Merry Christmas, Jim. Have this bottle of 18-year-old scotch. Right? And then Jim puts it in the cabinet and it sits there. And then year after year, maybe it goes down because they have house guests who want to drink or something, but they don't really drink it. And they have one of those collections, just stuff that had been there forever, you know, that they never touched. And that they had long since hidden the key, right? The obsession was on. And when the obsession to drink is on, I will do anything, say anything, you know, knock anyone out of my way to get a drink. I mean, it's really unbelievable if you think about it. Because there's nothing else. I mean, if I really wanted a cheeseburger, I wouldn't destroy a relationship for it, you know. But I will destroy a relationship for a drink of whiskey, you know. And so I went to the garage, I took a pry bar, and I ripped the door off the liquor cabinet. There was no way I was getting away with it, and I knew that. If you tried to open the door, it fell on you, you know. And if you tried to put the key in the lock came out of the door. I mean, I destroyed it. But it didn't matter. All I needed, I just needed a drink. You know, so I drank everything in there in like 2 weeks, and I came home from work one day, and my dad had found out about it, and he said, you're either an alcoholic or you're homeless. And I knew what homeless meant, right? Like, you're out. But I didn't know what alcoholic meant. Alcoholic is what we said when I can drink more than you, right? Like, I'm such an alcoholic. And or something to be proud of, right? That's a label I was proud of. And what he meant was that I was going to go to this place called Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Because I got a couple uncles who've been sober like 20, 25 years at that time. And so they knew about it. And I was like, okay, whatever. Because I'll do anything to get out of trouble. Right? Just to get the heat off my back, I'll do whatever I need to do. You know, just so I can keep living the way I need to live and fly under the radar. So, you know, we opened up the phone book, you know, and looked up the Alcoholics Anonymous hotline, called them up. They told us about a meeting that was starting in like an hour, like 5 miles away. And I went there reluctantly, just to get out of trouble. You know, I sat in the back of the room and I tried to keep a pissed off look on my face the whole time. I don't know what was said. I don't remember any of the faces of the people that were there. But for some reason, at the end of the meeting, I raised my hand. I said, my name is Chris and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know what I'm doing. No, I didn't say I'm an alcoholic. I said, my name is Chris and I don't know what I'm doing here. And the meeting closed. And after the meeting, I was surrounded by sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous who were trying to, you know, get me to come grab coffee with them at the diner after that. You know, ask me what my plan was the next day. You know, do you want to go to a meeting tomorrow? Do you want to go to a meeting on Tuesday? Here's my phone number. Just doing what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is what we do. When somebody new comes in, they're hurting, they don't know what's going on, we reach out to them. And I wanted nothing that they were offering. You know, sober, to me, was the most painful thing ever. I mean, if I called you up and asked you what you were doing, if it didn't involve drinking, I wasn't interested. If it involved being sober, we weren't hanging out. That's just all there was to it. Like, there was nothing more unbearable to me than the idea of being sober. Like, why? Why would you ever want to be ever sober? I couldn't understand it. But I went to that meeting, and those people understood it. They didn't talk to me like the psychiatrist and the psychologist or anybody in a position of authority who just pointed their finger at me and told me that what I was doing was wrong and asked me why I didn't want to live differently. Right? Because nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous is confused about why I don't want to live differently, you know? All they said was, if you want what we have, just come with us. They weren't begging me, right? They weren't scolding me. And I think that stuck out to me. I think that I remembered that. You know, I think I remember not being sort of offended by the people in AA, you know, which I think is the great thing about this, right? Because we don't, the book says, you know, there's no lectures to endure, right? And so I gave them a fake phone number and went on my way. And so began my first and only attempt of ever stopping drinking on my own. And, you know, day one was kind of painful. It was just awful, you know, because you're just sober. It's just terrible. Day two and day three are great because people are telling you how good you look, right? Like, your eyes are unsinking from the back of your head. Like, your skin's not gray anymore. You know, you got some food in your stomach. And people are like, wow, you really look great. What's going on? Well, I stopped drinking. Well, you should stay stopped, you know? That's usually the response. But day four and five are awful. And all of a sudden, nobody's acting right. Everybody's pissed, making me angry, you know? And And I just got to take a drink, you know, and the insanity which precedes the first drink, the second step, right, talks about how we will be restored to sanity. I didn't understand that when I was new, because I thought, like, man, I'm not crazy, right? Like, I'm not in 7-Eleven talking to the Slurpee machine, you know? That's what I thought crazy was, and that's what I thought it was saying. But really what it's saying is that the insanity which precedes the first drink will be taken away, right? And that is, I take every single reason for not drinking, and I turn it around and I make a drink like a good idea. Even though 5 days before that, I had every reason in the world for never drinking again. Right? But now, Friday, I think that I should celebrate my 5 days of being sober by getting good and drunk. You know, it just doesn't make any sense at all. But I did it, you know, and it made sense to me. And the next year, the year after high school, was pretty bad. My parents ended up kicking me out. You know, I flounder from job to job, group of friends to group of friends. I'm like a swarm of locusts with people, you know. I change groups of people every 4 to 5 months when I'm drinking because I use and take from these people to the point where they can't stand me anymore. And then I got to go find new people to go take from, you know. So if you looked at my life in 4 or 5 month increments, I would just have, like, new best friends all the time, you know. And nobody ever really getting to know me, because once you got to know me, it was not a pretty sight. And you were pretty much sick of me. But by the end of that year, I had got myself in some serious trouble, and I was faced with either going to jail or going to rehab. And like the homeless alcoholic question, right? Like, I'm not stupid. Like, let's go to rehab. I know both got 3 squares a day and a bed to sleep in, but I don't want to go to jail. Rehab's only 28 days, so I'll go there, freshen up, you know, get away from the booze for a little bit, you know, because like the book says again, you know, the idea that separation from alcohol from a period of time could allow me to drink like a normal person, you know. And I just thought if I could get away for 30 days, you know, clean up. Once I got back, I'd just get a job. I'll get into school, you know, and we'll start this process over again. But the rehab had different ideas. They suggested that I go to a halfway house down in Florida. And my parents were more than happy to help me buy a one-way ticket. You know, and so I went to Florida to go get, I honestly don't know what was going through my mind at the time. You know, I think I was just kind of rolling with the punches, like, this is what I'm dealing with, I don't really have a choice. You know, my life was in such a situation that I had really no control over what was going to happen. You know, my parents were going to send me to rehab, they were going to send me to, if I came home, they weren't going to allow me in, so I might as well go to this halfway house. So I went down to the halfway house. They told me to get a sponsor, get a job, pay rent, work the steps. And I found a guy who said he'd sponsor me. I mean, as far as I could tell, this guy was doing what we do. He said yes when I asked him to sponsor me. He picked me up for meetings. He tried to take me through the steps. But someone in my condition, I was not... I would raise my hand in a meeting and say, my name's Chris, I'm an alcoholic. But really, I did not believe that I was an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Right? I knew that drinking was a problem. You know, And at the time, I probably didn't know the difference between those two, right? But an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, that means that, and this is what I believe I am today, that the only solution for my problem is one of a spiritual nature, right? The only solution to my drinking is coming here and working with you people and then passing that on to someone else. But at the time, I didn't understand, comprehend, or care. And so we got through he walked me through the first 3 steps, you know, we did some reading and stuff. But when it came to the time of the 4th step, I wasn't interested, you know. And when I get sober, I'm uncomfortable again, right? I experienced the restlessness, the irritability, and the discontentment that you know, the book talks about, right? And I'm not thinking, and when I feel that way, I don't think, oh, I need to get God quick, you know. I'm thinking, like, she's cute. You know, or I need that money, or I need that apartment, or I need that job. And at that time, you know, she was blonde and had blue eyes, you know, and she said she loved me. You know, and at 3 months sober, that feels really good. You know, it actually almost feels like real happiness. But really, for me, it was just obsession. And we decided when I was 7 months sober and she was like 4 months sober that we should move in together. It'd be a good idea. You know, everyone I know said, Chris, this is a terrible idea. Terrible, terrible idea. And it's like, you don't want me to be happy. Why do all these people in AA not want me to be happy? You know, if I think that, I'm way off base. Even today, if I'm like, my sponsor doesn't want me to be happy, I need to take a look because there's something wrong. And my sponsor doesn't really care if I'm happy or not. He just wants me to take the actions, you know. So, yeah, we moved in together against everybody's direction, and within 6 days we were drinking and smoking crack, you know, because that's what happens to me when I go against sponsored direction, you know. It falls off pretty quickly. And, you know, within a month I was homeless again. She was gone. All the money was gone. The apartment was gone. I was just living on the beach in Fort Lauderdale, you know, just withdrawing from all kinds of crap. And I called this guy who had been my sponsor, who was about 45 minutes away from me. I told him I needed help. I had actually just gotten kicked out of a homeless shelter. And I used to take a meeting in the St. Elizabeths in southeast D.C., right? And there's some pretty wretched drunks in there. I mean, active alcoholics. And a lot of times all I could think about was, these guys are in here, but I got kicked out of a place like this. Like, I was so bad that they asked me to leave, you know. And then these guys are in there with, like, their poopy pants, you know, just puking all over the place. But they asked me to leave. You know, what does that say about me? And, you know, so I called this guy up. And within an hour, like I said, it was 45 minutes away. Within an hour, he was there picking me up. So I don't know what he had going on that day. Right, I don't remember what day of the week it was. I don't know if it was a work day, if it was a weekend. But, you know, when I wake up, I don't allot 4 or 5 hours of my day to go pick up drunk new guys. You know, like, I have things that I have going on, but this guy dropped everything he was doing. And he came and he picked up a sick and suffering alcoholic. And he let me detox on his couch for a couple of days. And, of course, you know, I'm so delusional. I don't think I'm detoxing. I just think it's odd that I'm getting sick now, you know. And but and he helped me get back into my halfway house. You know, and this time I was pretty certain that, I mean, it seemed obvious that I was an alcoholic, you know. And if you asked me, once again, I would tell you that I'm an alcoholic and I need to be in AA. But when push came to shove, I wasn't willing to take the actions. You know, I'm especially stupid and stubborn. And I have to be really beaten into a state of reasonableness, and I wasn't ready. You know, I went through the steps with this guy. He had me, actually, he moved away when I had a couple months sober, and I got his pigeon brother as my sponsor. And this guy was also a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsored a couple other people, was very active in meetings, you know. And he had me start on the fourth step, you know, but if you drank the way that I drank, if you lived the way that I lived, then there's things about yourself, you know, things that you've hidden from others, or the things that you've done to drink the way that you drink, the things that I've done to other people, that are just so shameful and despicable, that you just know emphatically that you will never tell another person this as long as you live. The kind of stuff that sometimes today, 8 years sober, when I think about it and I'm by myself, all by myself in my room, I drop my face into my hands because I'm so ashamed. You know, and I mean, it gets better the longer we stay sober and the more we help other people. But I mean, I've done some horrible things to people. You know, I was not raised to treat other human beings on this earth that way. And I left a lot of stuff off the fourth step because I didn't want to have to tell another person that. Some of it I was ashamed of. Some of it I was just outright embarrassed of. You know, I mean, we did a lot of weird things out there. You know, and then when it came time to do the eighth step, same thing, you know. There's just people I don't have to pay back. There's people I don't ever want to have to face eye to eye. So I left them off there. You know, and that was that was very indicative of my sobriety. You know, not willing to be honest, not willing to take action. You know, not really willing to give this my all. And, you know, half measures availed us nothing. You know, and there was some, I had service positions, and we had this group of young people down there in Florida. There's probably about this group of us. We had like 20 of us, and you know, we were pretty tight. We'd go to all meetings together, you know, we'd go to events together. And but you know, in where I was, it's very, very densely populated with treatment centers. You know, so there's a lot of brand new people. You know, so there, I mean, if you have like 3 years down there, you're an old timer. So needless to say, there's a lot of bad ideas floating around, and nobody really said I wouldn't do that. You know, and unless it was really bad. I mean, if somebody down there was telling you it was a bad idea, you should really listen to that. You know, and but. So, you know, we were just doing whatever we wanted. You know, after a meeting, you know, there might not be something to do, so we'll go to a lounge or go to a bar or go to a club, you know. These are places that I used to go to get drunk. Places that if I'm telling you that I am powerless over alcohol, that I have no power over alcohol, that's a place that I have no business being. Why would I go to the place that I have no control over what my actions are going to be? You know, most of the time I'm not going to want to drink. What happens if I'm in the habit of going to these places and I do want to drink? It's right there. You know, and those 20 people or so people that we used to hang out, they're all gone. You know, some of them are dead. Some of them are in jail. I know one guy's doing 25 up in Maryland because he robbed a bank. And I know at least three of them are dead. One of them was my best friend, you know. And to my knowledge, I'm the only one who's been able to crawl back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and be sober. So, I mean, you know, that's how we were living, you know. But I was about 18 months sober, and I started sitting in meetings, and I think, I don't need to hear this crap. And at this time, the outside stuff's got good. I mean, the outside stuff gets good real quick for most of us. You know, I had a good job. I had a cute girlfriend. I was in school. I was doing well. You know, I had a nice apartment. Had friends. All this outside stuff. And started thinking, I guess in the back of my mind, I did that, right? You know, that's me. And I'd sit in meetings and I'd think, I don't need to hear your crap. Like, God, you people complain a lot. You know, I don't want to hear about what you feel, you know. And maybe I made too big a deal of this drinking business. Do I need to go to a meeting all the time over a liquid? I mean, it's a liquid, people. Come on. You know, and those are the thoughts that go through my mind. I don't think I'm not an alcoholic. I think I'm an alcoholic, but I mean, it's just a liquid. I don't think I need to go to, I could just not drink, you know. And then I started, you know, cutting back my meetings, you know, 7 a week, 5 a week, 3 a week, 1 a week. And once you're down to 1 a week, I mean, you're so loosely associated with Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, if you slip away, nobody's going to notice anyway, because you're pretty much already gone. And that's what I did, you know, and I had this guy, Doug, that we had gotten sober together. I mean, we were running buddies. We were real tight. I mean, at that point in my life, this guy was the best friend I'd ever had. Know me better than anybody, and I'd known him better than anybody had known him. You know, we'd hang out every day doing stuff. And we both kind of were on the same loser path, right? Like they say, stick with the winners. That also means that there are losers, you know, and we were them. You know, we were the ones who were saying, like, you don't need to do that. Right? Those people are full of it. You know, those are the losers in AA. And so we were them, and we left, you know, because we got resentful. And we had moved in together. We were both back in school, working, doing well on the outside, but, you know, We widened up with it for like 4 or 5 months, like going to clubs and bars, dating girls that were drinking, you know. And I mean, one time I had a drinking party at my house for people from work. You know, I bought a bunch of cases of beer, a bunch of steaks. People came over, I grilled the steaks, people drank. And there was like a case of beer left over at my house. Right, I'm sober. I don't even drink, and I don't see anything wrong with it, you know. So, but probably 4 or 5 months later, you know, I'm driving back, and I'm driving up to the grocery store to go shopping at night, and it's been 4 or 5 months I've been to a meeting, you know, even longer since I talked to a sponsor or done any step work. And, I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous is so far out of my mind at this point, you know, it couldn't be further. You know, I'm in the grocery store, and just like our friend Jim in the Big Book, who thought that going to the deli where he used to drink would be a good idea, you know, I'm in the beer aisle. Because I think frozen pizzas were on one side, you know, and beer was on the other. And suddenly the thought crossed my mind that a case of beer would be nice. And I looked at my girlfriend, who was non-alcoholic, who never knew that I was in AA. I said, hey, let's get a case of beer. She said, yeah, let's do it. Put a case of beer in, you know. I vaguely sensed I wasn't being any too smart. But, you know, I went home, and, I twisted the top off that first bottle. And I can remember it as vividly today as I did that, because I did the next day. You know, I remember the soggy, wet paper on the bottle underneath my fingertips, condensation running down the bottle. You know, I remember putting that bottle to my lips and feeling the cold glass and smelling beer for the first time in almost 2 years. Oh, and it smells so good. But I thought, this is going to get really bad. And I just knocked it back. It had been so long since I had any kind of solution in my life. I just had anything in between me and a drink. Right? I mean, the book says that we have no mental defense against the first drink. Our defense must come from a higher power. Well, I was so far removed from a higher power that I had no choice really but to drink. I'm powerless over alcohol. And I got drunk that night, and I got drunk the next night, and I got drunk the next night. You know, it was like I never stopped drinking. You know, and come to find out, my friend Doug started drinking right around the same time. It was actually kind of unbelievable. I mean, spiritual likes attract, but I mean, we were really like right parallel paths, you know. But what scared me was that Doug was a heroin addict, right? Doug, and I knew that he was going to go back to heroin, you know, And one night, you know, I heard him, I had the night off work, and I heard him come home from work, and I heard him come home, he'd been at a party or something, he went into his room, and And he didn't come out. And I don't know, for some reason, something was just suspicious to me, you know. So, and I knew, I was pretty sure he was shooting dope again. So I, like, opened his door. He wasn't in his room. And I heard the water run in the bathroom. And I picked and locked his bathroom door and opened it up. And there he was, just, you know, in the fetal position on the floor. And I was pretty sure he was overdosing from heroin, you know. But when I'm drinking, I'm a total animal. When I'm drinking, if you stand in the way of my drinking, you will get knocked out of the way. All the time. It doesn't matter how much I say I care about you or how much I really do care about you. And I closed the door on my best friend. And I went back to my room and I kept drinking. You know, and when I woke up the next day, the dog, which he always lets out like in the morning, he crapped all over the house. You know, and he just made a huge mess in the house. So I knew the dog hadn't been up. And it was like 11 o'clock. So I went back to, and I had this eerie feeling, you know, and I went back into his room and opened the bathroom door, and he was just bloated and blue, laying in the exact same position that I had seen him the night before, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know if he was dead when I saw him, but, you know, this is a guy that I said was my best friend, and all I could think was, like, what did you do? What did you do? And you could have saved him. And, but I was drinking, man. I don't care about anybody else when I'm drinking, you know. And I used his death as an excuse to drink the way that I wanted to drink for a long time after that. You know, if you've been through what I've been through, you know, and I didn't tell anybody the full story, right? All I told him was I found Doug. I didn't tell him about the night before. It wasn't until years sober that I had the courage to tell anybody what happened that night, you know? But the next year and a half, man, I don't need to give you the details. It was deplorable. The worst year and a half of my life. I'd done things and went places. Like I said before, I wasn't raised to live that way, you know? And I remember I got evicted from I had this girlfriend, and she was kind of like my higher power, right? She kind of helped me keep things together. Like, as long as I had her, like, I had a motivation to, like, keep the power on, you know? And, because girls don't want to date a guy who has no power in his apartment, you know? So, but she moved away, and we broke up. Man, I just fell to pieces quick. I lost the job. I couldn't pay my bills. You know, I was living in this moldy, algae-infested apartment in South Florida in the middle of the summer with no AC, no electricity, you know, just swatting the mosquitoes at night so I could, you know, try and sleep. And I can remember just, like, you know, scrounging some money together and, like, getting a warm case of Coors Light and sitting on my couch in pitch black dark, sweating, drinking warm beer. And as long as I could get a couple beers down, it was all right. I heard somebody share recently that they have an amazing ability to lower their standards. And drinking allows me to do that. I can lower my standards to a point that is just unbearable to me if I'm sober. But as long as I'm drunk, man, I feel like a king. You know, and I'm sitting there in this apartment with mold growing on the walls and the carpet and just mosquito infested. And I'm thinking, it's all right, I'll fix it tomorrow. I'll fix it tomorrow. I'll go get a job. We'll get the money together. We'll go pay the power bill. We'll get the power turned back on. We'll clean up this mold. It's all good. You know, but as soon as I woke up, all I could think about was, where am I going to get drinking money? You know? And eventually I got kicked out of there. You know, I moved into these drug dealers. And I was just laughing myself a second ago because it just occurred to me a little while. I moved into these drug dealers, and I remember we were awake one morning at 10 a.m. just drinking. You know, that's what we do. 10 a.m., you wake up and drink, you know, and we're watching TV, and this commercial comes on, it's like, Fort Lauderdale Gun Show, guns, guns, guns. And now these drug dealers, they didn't have guns. And I was like, guys, what kind of drug dealers are you? You guys don't even have guns. Come on, we need to go get guns. So we loaded up, and they were actually against it at first. Like, no, man, we don't need guns, bro. And I was like, no, you need guns. And then within 10 minutes, I had them all riled up, and we were, like, loading up in the car. We came back with, like, four shotguns, a couple pistols. I mean, we were armed to the teeth, you know. And that night we went out shooting the Everglades, pretending we were going gator hunting, you know. But fast forward, like, 3 months later, I owe these guys a lot of money. And they're looking for me. And I'm scared to death. And I'm the idiot who armed them, you know. But, you know, so some of this, I mean, it's really, it's tragic, but it's kind of funny, you know. I mean, my mom wouldn't think it's funny, but, you know, we do. So, you know, I started getting locked up, you know, not for anything. I'm not a big, tough criminal, but just, like, drunk in public, possession, trespassing, you know, just general societal nuisance, you know. I actually got arrested by the same cop in the same place for the same three charges in like 4 days. You know, the guy was on like a first name basis with me. And the third time, he took pity on me, right? Because he could tell what wretched shape I was in. I remember he took me back to the local station and he had me cuffed to the bench. And at this point, man, I'm eating like every other day. I mean, if I got a couple bucks, it ain't going to food. You know, I'm drinking. And he came in and he's like, "Chris, have you eaten anything?" I was like, "Dude, I haven't eaten in days." And he brought me some of their leftover pizza. He's like, you want some Coke? I was like, "I would love some Coke." He brought me in a big glass of ice. And this is a cop that's just arrested me three times in less than a week, you know? And I begged him not to take me back to county. I said, "I'll leave the state." He's like, but you have court. And I was like, "Right, I'll be back." You know, and I was like, "I'm going to rehab. I'm going to rehab." And I swore to him I wasn't going to be back, and I'd come back for court, but I was going to leave the state. And the guy didn't even take me back to county. It was kind of unbelievable. But you know, at this point, I'm only talking to my parents every couple months, just to let them know I'm alive. Because they know what's up when I'm drinking. They know the game. I was able to manipulate them for a little while because they were still thinking I was sober, right? But once it became evident that I wasn't sober, I was done. And I remember calling my parents. That was in like March that I started making constant trips to jail. You know, but back in like December, I remember calling. I hadn't talked to my parents like 3 or 4 months, and I called my mom. I called my parents' house on Christmas Day, collect from a payphone. And my dad answered, and I was like, "Hey, Dad, it's Chris. Just want to let you guys know I'm doing all right." And he's like, "Hold on, your mother's coming to the phone." I was like, "Dad, I got to go." And I just hung up the phone. Because I'm living like that, man. I can't talk to my mom. You know, I got so much shame and guilt because I know that she knows how I'm living. You know, I'm living in total squalor, you know. And I just hung up the phone. And I know it probably broke her heart, you know. And I know, I found out later on that every once in a while she would call. She'd make a round of phone calls to the morgues in South Florida to see if they found my body. Like, she knew what happened to my friend Doug, you know, and she knew that we were the same person. She just expected any moment to hear about her son being dead down in Florida, you know. And I've never heard her say it, but I'm sure there's many sleepless nights. I don't have any children, but I can only imagine the kind of pain that I put that woman through. And, you know, my dad, too. But, you know, so around April, and my sobriety date's April 7th, and around beginning of April, you know, I talked to my mom, and she said I was welcome to come home for Easter. My dad said, if you're going to come home, you're going to be sober. You know, but at this point, I had no driver's license, no birth certificate, no social security card, no photo ID, nothing. I mean, I couldn't take a plane, I couldn't take a train, I couldn't take a bus, I had no money. You know, and I ended up hitching up to Fairfax on April 6th. Got there, I knocked on my parents' door at 5:30 in the morning on April 7th, 2004. You know, at this point, it's been like 17 hours since I've had a drink, so I'm like, you know, I'm shaking, and I'm DTing, you know, I'm withdrawing, and I'm just miserable. And at 7:15, I was sitting in the Unity Club, which is in a clubhouse in Falls Church, right down from where I live now, actually. And I just started, you know, I just sat in meetings all day long, you know, and I didn't talk to anybody. And I don't know what was different this time, but I was just broken. And the only reason I didn't come back to Alcoholics Anonymous is anybody was telling me to, you know. I just, I had, you know, we talk about this sense of impending doom. We talk about, you know, we could just feel there was something bad was going to happen. It wasn't a feeling. I can say with some assurance, I got sober when I was 23. I can say with some assurance there's no way I would have seen my 24th birthday, you know. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and you people were here just doing what you'd always done, you know. But if it wasn't for the fact that I was able to hitch up to Fairfax, I would have died drunk in Florida because I had too much pride and ego to walk back in the rooms down there. I drank for a year and a half so that you people wouldn't be right, you know, so that you people wouldn't be able to say I told you so, right? Which nobody's ever told me here, but that's what my head told me, you know. So I'm running out of time here. I only got 10 minutes, so I'm gonna get sober. You know, I ended up meeting this guy in that clubhouse. You know, he didn't normally go to that meeting, but he stuck his hand out to me, told me that he was a member of a very active young people's group, and would I like to go to a camp out that weekend? I was like, I would love to. I was so lonely at this point. I mean, we talk about alcoholic loneliness. You know, when I was down there in Florida, I would be sleeping on the beach, like in the sand, just DTing, and I would just wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and just grab my backpack and start walking. Nowhere to go, no one to see, no friendly direction to turn in, just walking, all alone. You know, and this guy's asked me if I want to go to a camp out with him. I should be, yes, yes, I want to go to a camp out, you know. And he took me, and then I got swept up in this group, you know. I had a terrible attitude. I mean, I was really angry. I don't know what I was so angry about. I mean, you people were offering me a brand new way of life, but I was just ticked off. And I couldn't even have told you why. I actually didn't think I was. I thought I was pretty happy. But at a year sober, people were like, I can't believe you stayed sober, you know. And I didn't have that much willingness, once again. Like I said, I'm stupid and stubborn. But I had just enough willingness to be just as honest as I needed to be. You know, right? I wrote that fourth and the fifth step. And I did the fifth step with my sponsor. And I put down all those things that I thought were going to shame me out of here. I didn't think they were going to shame me out of here. I just didn't have to tell anybody that stuff. You know what I mean? It's just rotten stuff. And he shared his experience with me, you know. He had done just as bad of stuff as I had, you know, with the exception of the Doug thing, you know. And at that point, like I said, it took me a long time to get really honest about that situation, and that wasn't it yet, you know. So I did my fourth and fifth step, and I pretty much stopped there. Like, that was the willingness of what I was at, you know. I make sure to reassure new guys that I sponsor, because they start worrying about, like, oh my God, I owe so much money. I'm like, don't worry, that is a long way away. We all know you're not capable of that yet, you know. And because people talk about like the eighth and ninth step, and be like, oh man, I really don't want to do that. Like, that seems like so much work, and I owe so much money, you know. And really, like I said, like, I just wanted the outside stuff, you know. I got my cute girlfriend, I got a car, I got my apartment, I got my job, right? I got all the outside stuff, and at a year sober, it was all gone within a matter of days, you know. Well, I mean, it wasn't all gone, but the stuff that I depended on was gone. She broke up with me. The job let me go, you know, and I was faced with that dilemma, right? Like, leave AA, because I was so miserable. Now, which in my mind never says go drink; it just says leave AA, like, go away, and or get busy doing what all these really annoying happy people are doing, you know. And I hated the happy people. But I called the annoying happy people, you know, and they told me to do things like pick up new people, you know, and get service positions and help with this event and help with that event. And all of a sudden, I quickly became one of the happy people, you know. I became one of the people that, like, I hated, you know. And life got good. And really, I rode the service wave for a long time without taking any action. I sponsored some guys. I was 12. I was two-stepping, you know. And it wasn't until, you know, we were talking about one of our friends from California. You know, I was, I had warrants out for my arrest because I lied to the cop. I never went back, you know. And my sponsor had told me that before I got started on the eighth and ninth step, I had to start cleaning up the wreckage of my past that was still occurring, you know. And that was, I owed the state of Florida amends, you know. They had three warrants, 14 charges for my arrest, and I had to go down there. And I was not willing to go down there. Our sponsor once said, you have no idea how badly you want to take care of this. And I thought, yo, bud, you have no idea how badly I don't want to take care of this. And going to jail sober did not seem appealing to me at all. But one day I was driving around my work truck. You know, I have my own business. Things are going really good for me, you know. And I thought, if I don't take care of this, I'm a dead man. Like, I'm going to get drunk. And to me, it seemed like an epiphany. My sponsor had been saying it for years, literally years. But to me, I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to get drunk. And I called my sponsor. I was like, hey, man, I got to do this. He's like, yeah. Yeah, you do, dummy. And you know, within a month, I was down there turning myself in and posting bond, you know. And somebody came down there with me, right? And then a month later, I went back down for court. And I had letters from people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had tax returns that I had filed. You know, I had a Virginia driver's license, which the judge really liked that I was in Virginia, right? Like, you're not Florida's problem anymore. And they dropped 9 of the charges, let me off the court costs, you know, and I didn't do any time in jail, which is strange, because if I would have shown up for the court dates that I was supposed to, I probably would have gone to jail, you know. But you know, the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous are many, you know, and that allowed me to get, you know. And then later that summer, I was sitting in a conference that we do back at home called SOP, you know, and I heard this guy from California talk about how, you know, when he was using, he was swimming out of a lake with his buddy that he was banging dope with. And his buddy went out and drowned in the lake. He was going to go save him until he realized that if he drowned, he could have his dope. And then later on, he talked about making amends to this guy. And I knew that was my guy. You know, I knew that this was the guy I was going to have to talk to. And then I got his phone number after that conference, and I started calling him. Because there was more than just letting my friend Doug die, right? Like, I knew his family. Like, I knew his mother. I knew his stepfather. I knew his grandparents, his little brother, and his little sister. And after that day, I never spoke to any of them. I was too drunk to show up for his funeral. I was too drunk to show up for his memorial service. I was too drunk to answer his mother's phone calls. You know, and it had been 6 years since I'd talked to her. You know, and it had been almost 6 years since Doug had died. And so I'm talking to him and trying to figure out, you know, what can I do? Because at this point, I've gone through an 8-step with my sponsor. You know, I want to go start making the process of amends. And this guy told me to write a letter to him, right? Because he's dead, and I obviously can't go see him. You know, so write a letter to him and read it to my sponsor. And I read a letter of what I recalled happening that night, what I wish I'd done instead, and how I'm living today. And I read it to my sponsor, and I cried for the first time since the day Doug died. You know, and I had no idea that every single night before I went to bed, I'd picture my friend's Doug face. You know, and I have an amazing ability to push these things down. You know, just not think about them. You know, I like to think things don't bother me. But I was haunted by my past. You know, I read this letter to my sponsor, and the first thing he had me do was go read it to my pigeon brother, who had a similar experience. Right? Because that's what everything in this program is designed to do, is to mold me into a person who can be of maximum service to another alcoholic. You know, but you know, as far as his mother, like I felt so guilty about his mother. You know, I was the last person who had seen her son alive, you know, and she didn't, and I just dropped off the face of the earth, you know, and my friend out in California told me that, you know, I had no right to contact her and just start dredging up all these awful, terrible memories of the past that she might just now be coming to terms with, and we agreed that I got to leave her alone, you know, and so I did, and we were going to let God figure it out, you know. 6 days later, I got an email from her, right? Mind you, I haven't spoken to her in 6 years, asking me how I'm doing, you know, basically inviting me back into her life, and it didn't make any sense, you know, how do these things happen, right? Like, I understand that there's a word coincidence, but I didn't think it applied to that situation, you know, and, you know, I started talking to her, turns out she lives in Cincinnati now, and I was like, man, I never go to Cincinnati, when am I going to go to Cincinnati, you know, and one of our friends that spoke here last time I was here, called me up like a couple weeks later, like, hey man, you want to go to a conference in Cincinnati this summer? You know, and when I show up and I'm willing to take these actions, God opens doors that I never could. You know, God makes all things possible, you know, through the people around me. And as long as I'm willing to stay here and take the actions to try and help another person, you know, and I got to meet with her and point her towards Al-Anon, because she's been struggling for a long time. And I got to share my experience about going to a place where people have the same problem that I do. You know, so that whole situation in the end, or that whole amends in the end, turned out that my purpose was to help her. Not to clear my conscience, right, but to help her and to help somebody else. You know, I've got to share that experience with a lot of people since I've gone through it. You know, and it's been a few years since then. And my amends to my friend Doug is not over. It will be going on for the rest of my life. You know, like, and I understand, don't get me wrong, I am self-centered enough to think that he's dead because of me, but, you know, he's not. He put the needle in his arm, you know? But I don't know if I didn't try to help somebody that I called my best friend, you know? And I know for a fact today that I'm surrounded by people who would do anything to help me, right? Like real friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Not like I was to my friend Doug or other people in my life. And my amends to my friend Doug is to look out for people like him and me. Look out for the guys who are coming into the meetings, you know, just total boneheads who don't know what they're doing, who can't stop drinking, you know. And I remember a little while after the meeting, because I felt really good. You know, we make a couple amends, you know, and the book tells us to be careful not to rest on our laurels, for we're going to be in trouble if we do, because alcohol is a subtle foe. And, you know, maybe like a year later, I remember, like, I started thinking about Doug, and I felt guilt. And I realized what the guy who I worked with the amends had said. You know, if I want to stay free of the guilt, I got to keep making these amends by helping others. And I wasn't helping anybody. You know, and today I can say that's not the case. I got four clowns that call me all the time, and, you know, I get to work through the steps with them, and other people that I try to reach out for. You know, and when I think about Doug, I remember him fondly. You know, and as a result of helping others, I get to feel comfortable in my own skin. You know, there's some things that I can eke by slacking on. Like, I might be able to, like, not call my sponsor for a week and then have to, like, you know, frantically get current with him, or maybe I don't have as many service positions as I should, and it might take me a little while to realize that. But nothing so surely makes me feel uncomfortable as when I go a short period of time without helping anybody. Right? Because my selfishness, my self-centered is so powerful right, that it can just change my mood like that. And I'll be like, what is going on? And I realize I'm not helping anybody, you know, and I am out of time, but I just wanted to say with my family, you know, I wasn't allowed in their home. When I came into their house, my mom put her purse on her shoulder. My dad instantly started calculating how much money he had in his wallet. And my brothers wanted nothing to do with me, you know, and that's not the case today. When my parents go out of town, they ask me to come over and watch their house and their dogs, you know. My brother graduated from school last year, and he moved out to California. And me and him got to load up a box truck with his stuff and drive all the way out to California together, you know. And I remember one night, my phone rang like 12:45 at night. It was my little brother, you know. And I answered the phone, and he was just bawling and crying. Him and his girlfriend had just broken up. And the first person that he thought to call was his older brother. And that's not me, right? That's you people, you know? And I get such an awesome life here. And it's not the outside crap. You know, I got lots of cool stuff that goes on the outside. But that doesn't fill me up inside. You know, I got a car full of guys that we drove down here today. You know, and that's the fun stuff, right? Getting to get together and go somewhere and share our experiences together, right? And pass this message to others. That's the good stuff. And I'm really grateful to be here, and I really appreciate you guys letting me come out and talk to you. Thanks for sharing.